From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're wrapping up our series of shows marking the 40th anniversary of when the LDS Church lifted its priesthood and temple ban on black members. We'll talk about the pressure church leaders felt from outside of the church, but also from within, because there was a lot of maneuvering going on at church headquarters in the years before 1978. We'll also hear reaction from one black Latter-day Saint who stayed despite the racism he encountered. After this.
On the next More to Say, this question. Who actually owns the United States border with Mexico? If you think it's the federal government, you're wrong. The U.S. is indeed the largest landowner in the region, but most of the land itself is privately owned. Now, Donald Trump ran for office promising to build a wall between America and Mexico. But he's got a problem. Lots of the landowners down there don't want a border wall. The people who own the border, on the next More to Say. Download it today, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. You had two conflicting emotions going on Friday night as the LDS Church commemorated the 40th anniversary of the day they announced they were lifting the temple and priesthood ban on black members. The church called the performance at the Conference Center in Salt Lake City a celebration of the announcement. And those who attended said it was powerful and beautiful to see African culture on stage, to hear stories of black pioneers. But there was also some disappointment by current black Latter-day Saints that church leaders had chosen not to use that performance as an opportunity to acknowledge the pain of the past or to apologize for cruel policies and bad ideas that kept the ban in place for more than 160 years. Today in the program, we're going to wrap up our coverage of this story with some final thoughts. Later on the program, we'll hear from one of those African-American Latter-day Saints who has felt those conflicting emotions. But we're going to begin by talking about the years that led up to the lifting of the ban in 1978. We have to go back to the 1960s, when the president of the LDS Church was a man named David O. McKay. Our guest is Gregory Prince. He's an independent historian and biographer who specializes in Mormonism. He wrote a biography of David O. McKay, and he joined us from a studio in Washington, D.C. Tell us what's happening in those years leading up to all of this within the church itself, the pressure the church is feeling. Start with David O. McKay in the 1960s. Just generally give us a sense of the political social landscape.
Okay, well, there was a positive force acting on him, and there was a negative force acting on him at the same time, and that set up a paradox that never really got resolved. The negative force was that the civil rights movement was blossoming. Utah had not been an exemplary state in civil rights. In fact, some characterized it as a southern state in everything but geography. Mm-hmm. McKay himself and most of his associates, by today's standards, were racist. He dug in against the civil rights movement. He really did not agree with it. He thought, for instance, that business owners ought to be able to provide services or deny services on the basis of their own judgment, and that the government had no right regulating that. On the positive side, because of LDS literature that had been circulating within Nigeria, there was a great desire on the part of many Nigerian natives to learn about Mormonism, and they had made a request to Salt Lake City. So in about 1963, there were ongoing intense discussions within the LDS First Presidency. Can we start a mission in Nigeria given that we have this priesthood ban? So there are really those contradictory forces acting on McKay in the early 1960s.
Let me ask you about the negative force acting on David O. McKay and his own opinions about civil rights. Did he see civil rights as a moral kind of question, or was he able to disentangle moral from political or social?
I don't think for him it was a moral issue so much as a practical one. Now, he had a very strong aversion to interracial marriage, and I think that was part of his feeling about the civil rights movement in general.
How did he explain the ban? Did he believe that this was, in fact, God's will, or did he see it as this more complicated evolution of people like Brigham Young and other racist leaders of the LDS Church imposing their own view on it.
This is what he inherited as a church leader. But I think that his questioning of it went back to the early 1920s. In 1920 and 21, he and a companion, Hugh Cannon, went around the world visiting the foreign missions of the LDS Church. When he got to Hawaii, he encountered a couple, a very impressive couple. The wife was Native Hawaiian. The husband was African American. And he felt that it was an injustice in this particular instance that the man was not able to be ordained to the LDS priesthood. So he wrote a letter to Heber Grant, who was the church president, and said, could we make an exception here?
Wow.
The letter that came back said, David, I wish as much as you do that this could be changed, but it would take a revelation to do it. McKay never put down on paper, and I don't even think in conversation, probed his own depths as to what his evolution was on the subject. But I think that was one of its earliest points, that seemed to open the door in his mind that, yes, it is susceptible to change, but it would take a revelation to change it.
So wait, what did a revelation mean, though, to him? Did that mean that a revelation is just God getting in contact with the leaders of the church, or that there's a process where you go to God and ask? Do you know what I mean? Like, how did they figure that would work?
What he actually did was just to go to God in prayer. And he did this several times over a period of at least 14 years, from 1954 to 1968. I presume that he expected that if there were to be a revelation, it would take the form of some type of epiphany, but he never specified what it was that he hoped to get. What he did say in some of his later private communications was either there had been no answer, or in the case of the last gentleman who spoke on the subject, and this would have been in the context of 1968, that the answer had been, no, not yet. Now, whether that had been an audible voice or an impression, he didn't say.
Yeah. As far as you can tell, how much of this was LDS leaders like David O. McKay truly believing this was God's will, or just their own awareness of the kind of internal inertia within church bureaucracy and the politics in America of the time? Can you tell?
No, you have to infer, but by the time McKay became president, the policy had been in place for a full century.
Yeah.
And within a conservative religious tradition, no matter which one it is, something that is in place for that long achieves quasi-canonical status. And so the idea of challenging the status quo is very atypical for that type of conservative organization. So at least give McKay credit that he was really the first one to our knowledge that challenged it, even though he did it in private and he held the cards very close, so close that his closest associates weren't aware of it.
How complicated was it for church leaders, like mission presidents and missionaries in various places where they had African Americans or people of African descent who wanted to join the church? How complicated was it, and inconvenient even was it, to sort of ascertain whether or not they were from this certain lineage and whether they were allowed to be, you know, ordained within the priest? I mean, how complicated and inconvenient was it, do you think?
Shortly after he became president, he announced that he was going to travel to South Africa. No LDS general authority had ever visited the mission there prior to that. That mission opened in the early 1850s. But the reason he wanted to go is that he, in the first presidency, was receiving communications from the mission president down there. There was a policy that said you cannot ordain any man to the lay priesthood until you can trace all of his ancestral lines back to Europe.
Wow.
And so it was really a question of guilty until proven innocent. And it was paralyzing them. The mission president wrote and said, I have six missionaries working full-time on genealogical research, and we're just tied up in knots. We're not getting anything done here. We're not able to ordain anybody. So he went down, and in addressing a missionary conference in South Africa, he said on the spot, if there is not convincing evidence of black African lineage, then you may ordain the man. Now, church-wide, that didn't have a great deal of effect, but it really was a turning point that later achieved full fruition in 1978. But South Africa is where he first became aware of the logistical nightmare that this policy was creating. It wasn't just a philosophical thing anymore.
The internal politics we have to talk about, because they're really fascinating. Give us just a quick lay of the land in terms of the various factions. Now, the crucial player that I want to refer to is a man by the name of Hubie Brown. I guess in today's language, we would say he was a fairly conventional liberal, I suppose, in the way he thought of social policies and even in terms of his political leanings. Classical liberal, I guess, is probably the way to describe it. But what were the factions like in the 12 at the time? And talk a little bit about Hubie Brown in that context.
Many in the 12 didn't publicly take sides. Brown was in the first presidency from 1960 until McKay's death in 1970. So for that entire decade, he was not in on the discussions that were just within the Quorum of the Twelve. But yes, Brown was quite liberal. His nephew, Nathan Tanner, was the other counselor in the first presidency. And Tanner, I would characterize as either center or left of center.
Yeah.
Within the Quorum, there was really one voice that counted, and that was of Harold B. Lee, who was a senior apostle outside of the Quorum, but as an outside insider was Alvin Dyer, who was added to the first presidency in 1967. He became an important player because he sided with Lee in 1968 when the top echelon became aware of a meeting that had happened more than a decade earlier, where McKay told Sterling McMurrin that this was a policy and not a doctrine and that it was changeable and at some point it would change. So to understand the factions, you don't have to zero in on too many people.
Yeah,
you had primarily Hugh Brown on the one side and Harold Lee on the other, and nobody else counted that much, including Spencer Kimball.
Yeah.
He
wasn't a player,
non-entity
then.
At this point.
Yeah. Alvin Dyer, just I want to mention something that is interesting. His belief was black people could not receive the priesthood because spirits in this Mormon pre-existent state had refused the priesthood then and then were chosen to have the bodies of black people and they came down here. Do you want to say something about that? Because these various ideas are strange but interesting.
Well, since there was not a well-articulated rationale for the policy, people often with good intentions had built a scaffolding to try to support the policy. And different people came at it from different vantage points. It was an open field. Dyer had given an address in Oslo, Norway, to the Norwegian missionaries called For What Purpose? And that's where he articulated what you just talked about. That was circulated unofficially throughout missions throughout the world. It never had the official stamp of the church on it. But when I went to Brazil in 1967 as a missionary, that was part of the introductory packet that we were given when we were processed through the mission home.
Wow.
So it had quasi-canonical status in certain circles, and it carried a lot of weight, even though it never had any official endorsement, and Dyer was just out there on his own.
Wait, so you as a missionary in the 1960s in Brazil had to explain to black potential converts that the reason that they were going to not be allowed to receive the Mormon priesthood was because of a decision that they had made in this Mormon preexistence not to take the priesthood at that time. That must have been very awkward and strange.
Well, we never got that far, at least in my experience, because we were given rather rigid instructions, just avoid people who appear to be black. It was a terrible thing to have to go through, and I have regretted ever since that I even had to be part of it. But there was a lot of folklore that was circulating amongst the missionaries is, well, how do you tell? It was all bogus, but it was the best that we could do under extenuating circumstances. Mm-hmm. The instruction to the missionaries was that if there was an investigator who appeared to be of African origin, that that person was not to be baptized unless interviewed by the mission president. And I don't know how many of those interviews took place, but none of them involved people that I worked with.
Let's go back to Hubie Brown, who he is really trying to, it seems like he's trying to apply some kind of pressure on the church leadership. And he blindsides David O. McKay. This was, I think, in 1962, 1963. He gives an interview to a reporter with the New York Times. Wallace Turner is his name. And he basically says, yeah, we're close. We're going to lift the ban on black people in the priesthood. Let's talk a little bit about this story, because I guess David O. McKay was pretty upset about it.
He was upset about it. At about the same time period, in the context of their discussion, Nigeria, Brown raised the question in a First Presidency meeting, well, could we at least ordain them to the Aaronic priesthood? In the LDS church, there are two levels of lay priesthood. That's the lower of the two. On a practical level, that would have facilitated the creation of a functioning church within Nigeria, and you could use imported missionaries to perform other functions, but it really would have streamlined at least getting started. And McKay's response was, if you give them that, you give them everything. So the idea that Brown would be pushing on this probably started in that meeting, and it may have been that he was hoping to push the agenda by, in essence, I think, going rogue with that reporter and saying what he did.
McKay made him, I don't know if retract the statement, but say that he had been misquoted or something.
Yes. But about the same time, too, Brown did another thing that really did irritate McKay, and it was on the flip side of the coin, and that was civil rights, that the NAACP in Utah was so upset with what the church was doing that they threatened to picket the general conference. And so Brown, hearing of this, wanted to read something in general conference that would signal a truce. He went to Sterling McMurrin. McMurrin wrote the statement. McMurrin later told me that he had written it, and he said, I haven't told anybody that yet. And Brown took one sentence out, but that was the statement. He wanted it as an official statement. McKay says, no. We're not going to do that. So what Brown did, again, going a little rogue, was to stand up in general conference, and before he gave his prepared remarks, he read this statement without saying it's an official statement. But McMurrin said, if you watch the body language, everything about it said, listen up, folks, because this is official. So Brown was pushing not just the priesthood issue, but civil rights simultaneously.
All right. One more moment of Hubie Brown going rogue. Let's talk about 1969. And this is a point at which athletic teams, the NCAA, they're really raising questions about Brigham Young University and whether or not they're going to let their athletes play BYU teams because of the church's ban. So things are really heating up in terms of this external pressure. And in 1969, Hubie Brown really starts to initiate another attempt at changing this policy. Talk about what's happening in 69, because these stories are interesting, too.
Yes. You have to back up 1 year to see the context for this. And this was in 1968. Sterling McMurrin wrote a letter to Llewellyn McKay, one of McKay's four sons, and said, I have never talked to you about an incident that occurred in 1954 with your father. That's where he talked about the 1954 meeting where McKay had said, this is a policy and it will change. Brown had never encountered it in those terms. What he was trying to do in 62, 63, saying maybe we could ordain them to the lesser priesthood, was just coming out of the blue without any documentation on his part. Now he had something in hand, because Llewellyn shared this letter, and it went to Brown, but simultaneously it also went to Alvin Dyer, who shared it with Harold Lee. So what's happening is all of a sudden both sides have documentation that McKay himself felt that this was a policy that could be changed. What McKay had not said was, by the way, it will take a revelation to change it. That was a crucial missing piece. So Brown, sensing, okay, if this is just a policy, then policies can be changed administratively, and that's the charge that he took. Dyer and Lee thought, oh my gosh, if this is a policy, it might be changed administratively, and we've got to block it. And so the clash of the titans heated up pretty quickly beginning in 1968 and extending through 1969.
Say what happens in 1969, because basically what Hubie Brown does, he lobbies pretty much everyone in the Quorum of the 12 to get this agreement that they're going to change the policy. But he happens to do all of this when Harold B. Lee was out of town, which is important also. What happens?
Well, I don't have the details of that. In none of my research did I see documentation. I would hear bits and pieces about it. What I did hear from Brown's grandson, Ed Firmage, was that, in fact, Brown had tried to change it administratively, that when Lee found out about it after he came back from his travels, he was furious, and he went back to the 12 and had them change it back, and then a short time later, when McKay died, which was January of 1970, Lee, who became the de facto president of the church, he was first counselor to Joseph Fielding Smith, but Joseph Fielding Smith was 95 or 96 years old and in failing health. So everybody knew that Lee was the de facto president. Lee released Brown from the first presidency because he had been so furious that Brown had tried to change the policy administratively. And that was the first time that a sitting counselor, aside from health issues, had been released from a first presidency since the death of Brigham Young. So it really struck hard at Brown.
Greg Prince, I want to ask you about Spencer Kimball. He becomes president, and the perception, of course, is that he's very conservative in terms of his doctrine and in terms of the way he sees the church. That's the kind of the assessment that a lot of people have. But as you've pointed out, he turns out to be the most progressive church president of the 20th century. Talk a little bit about Spencer Kimball and where he's coming from, because you say that Kimball is asked in those first days when he becomes president about whether the ban is going to be lifted, and I'm not sure it's fair to say he equivocates, but it doesn't seem clear that that's going to happen.
Yes. To understand him, I think you have to go back to his childhood. He later talked about what he saw as discrimination of Native Americans, and his father was very sympathetic about that and I think sensitized him. Perhaps even more important, when I interviewed Tom Fiennes, who was a general authority, he said that when he was a mission president in Uruguay in about 1960, Spencer Kimball visited the mission. He said the two of us were sitting alone in one of the chapels. It was on a weekday. And Kimball said, Tom, this thing with the blacks is not right. Someday it has to change. So it was on his mind for at least two decades before it finally happened. But as you say, he was very conservative in the literal sense that he wanted to conserve the past and not to change anything. When I was talking to Ed, his son and his biographer, he said, my father was the best follower in the church. He would not have felt it appropriate to change anything, but he said one day he woke up and he was the church president and he had to lead instead of follow. And that's when things began to change. Now, I also asked him, was there any continuity between what McKay had tried to do and what Kimball did? And he said, I've seen not a shred of evidence that President McKay ever spoke to my father on this subject. It was two men who were just working in entirely separate spheres.
The pressure from Spencer Kimball, it seems like he also has negative pressure and this positive pressure. And the positive pressure, of course, is another kind of pragmatic. It's like in McKay's administration, the pragmatic concerns about what are we going to do in Africa. In Kimball's case, in Brazil was a big thing. So he also has those same kinds of things going on. And there's this really interesting conversation that you write about that he has with a man by the name of Jack Carlson, who was a Mormon who was in the Carter administration, if I get that right.
Yes, he was in a couple of administrations, yeah, both Democratic and Republican.
And the conversation that you've written about is really interesting. He has this conversation with Carlson where Kimball says to him, what do you think would happen if we changed this policy of blacks in the priesthood? What would happen? And what I find interesting about this is just how pragmatic he is. This Jack's wife is the one who told you that Kimball was really candid. She says there was no, I think I'm going to go pray about this. He was rational. He was political in this way. And this is a side that I've never seen of Spencer Kimball, the more rational, even more political part of him, thinking about what's the effect of this going to be, for example, on our members in the American South who might not take to this idea of changing the policy very kindly. To talk a little bit about this.
He was a very pragmatic man, and he was covering his bases both then and later. He was basically saying, look, I haven't made up my mind yet, but if this were to happen, you're the politician. How do you suggest it should be done? And as you say, Jack said, you act decisively and you move on. And in fact, that's the way that they did it. Now, that creates another set of problems, because you haven't addressed the issue of all the scaffolding that was propping up the policy for a century. But nonetheless, that was probably good advice from Jack and certainly taken as given by Kimball.
That's Gregory Prince. His books include David O. McKay and The Rise of Modern Mormonism. He joined us from a studio in Washington, D.C. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West from KUER.
Do you work for the University of Utah? Are you a public radio nerd? Then donate to KUER through payroll deduction. Decide how much of your paycheck you'd like to put toward programming like Morning Edition, 1A, and Radio West, and the university will send your generous gift to KUER. Your contribution supports factual journalism, Utah stories, and even short films. Get started with payroll deduction by looking under the support tab at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're wrapping up our series of shows marking the 40th anniversary of when the LDS Church lifted its priesthood and temple ban on black members. We have with us Gregory Prince. He's an independent historian and biographer. Joining us now on the program is Eugene Orr. Eugene joined the LDS Church in 1968. He was a founding member of the group called Genesis. It's a group of African-American members of the church. He also served as a second counselor to the first Genesis president. He remains an active Latter-day Saint, and he lives in Canada, near Edmonton. He joined us from the studios of the CBC there. Eugene Orr, I want to begin with your first contact with Mormonism. This came, as I understand it, was an encounter you had with a woman who would become your wife. Is that right?
No.
Oh, okay, good. I'm glad I asked. How did it work? Tell me how it worked.
I was at the Lewiston, California, Jobco Center as a corpsman. And I was getting ready to be transferred over to Clearfield Jobco Center in Utah. So before I left, there were some people that knew something about Mormons, because I never heard the word before, yeah, coming from Orlando, Florida, as a Baptist. And they says, so you've been transferred to Utah? I said, yes, I am. They says, so when you go there, we want to let you know that there are people called Mormons that are in Salt Lake City, Utah. And they claim to have the only true church on the face of the earth, and they don't like blacks. That was my first contact. So I sought after to find out which one of those statements were complete. So I came into Salt Lake City. So I was walking down the sidewalk down by the Greyhound bus station, and it was raining. I had my umbrella up, and she came out of the swinging doors of the bus station with some newspaper over her head, and she ran smack into me. So I bent down and picked up the paper and escorted her to the car with the umbrella, opened the door for her, and asked her the question, "Are you a Mormon?" And she said, "Yes, I am." I said, "So it was, I was told that Mormons did not like blacks, but you have the only true church on this earth." She said, "Well, I'm a Mormon, and I have nothing against blacks." And I said, "So what about this curse they talk about?" And so we kept talking about, and then she says, "By the way, why don't I have the missionaries, contact the missionaries and have them to come see you if you're coming in the next weekend?" Because I told her about we come in every weekend. "And meet me at my house." So that took place. And it was two female missionaries. I gave them both names. One was Miss Humble, and one was Miss Know-It-All. And so Miss Know-It-All, she was explaining to me about the curse. And she says, when you are baptized and you become righteous, you become, your skin will become white just like mine.
Wow.
I know. So, well, I had the impression that what she was saying was not correct. So I got past all that, and because I knew it wasn't correct. So over the discussions, we had six discussions, and when we got to the priesthood part of this discussion, that's when my wife, she contacted Dryas Gray. And that's how I met Dryas. Was when he came into the picture.
He was a baptized Latter-day Saint at the time.
Was a baptized Latter-day Saint at the time, working for KSL. And so I proceeded with the missionary discussion and prayed about it, as it talks about in the Book of Mormon. And I received my conversion answer through the power of the Holy Ghost, not through Lee and not through the missionaries. And so my testimony still today, no matter what happens, I'm on the spiritual side. There's so many other social things that goes on in the church that you have to encounter or deal with, but it still remains the same, that the Holy Ghost still bears testimony. And so I held fixed and tight to the gospel of Jesus Christ and through my testimony, regardless of what people were saying and what they were doing, because they said so many things, they did so many things. And the average person, if you didn't have a testimony, you would fall away. Simple as that.
Eugene, you've talked about what it was like going to church in Salt Lake City in those days, and I wanted to ask you a bit about that. You were told, as I understand the story, some of the white men in your ward were opposed to the idea of you attending priesthood meetings, and I just wanted to get a sense of what it was like in those days for a black man to attend a ward. A white ward, mostly.
Well, you know, coming into the church, and I came in August the 24th, 1968. And so Dryas had been in the church since 1964. Reverend Bridgeforth had been in the church since 1953. And so nothing was happening. And I came in almost like a black rebel, but not in a bad way, but in a good way. Because I wanted to find out what was happening to the black members of the church. They were not fellowshipped by no white people at all. So I gave them the title, the lost black sheep, literally, because they were black. So in my ward, in Park State, The bishop, I requested to go to the priesthood meeting, and the bishop indicated that he would have a meeting with the Melchizedek priesthood quorum and to talk with them to see if they would allow me to come to priesthood meeting. And so the next Sunday, he called me in and said that there was three brethren in the quorum would stop coming to priesthood if the bishop allowed me to come to priesthood. Don't you think it would be better for those who hold a priesthood to attend priesthood than those who do not hold a priesthood?
What was your answer to that?
I said, Bishop, you know, it's almost just like saying, would you rather be a non-member or a member?
Yeah.
So I said, well, that's something that you would have to answer to, and that's something that they would have to answer to God, not to me. And so I got a hold of President Hinckley, Apostle Hinckley at the time.
Yeah.
And I asked him, I said, so I was told I couldn't go to priesthood meeting. And he says, the bishop, he's the judge of Israel in his ward. So what decision he makes, he has the answer to God. And they cannot overrule that as an apostle. So that was okay. I understood that. But my dentist, he was a bishop in his ward. So we were very close. And I said, I can't go to priesthood in my ward. He said, well, if you're you want to go to priesthood, come over to my ward.
Wow.
So that's why that I wrote a letter as a special interest group of Genesis to all the apostles, requesting a common ground for all stakes, presidents, and all bishops to follow.
I want to ask you about a story from 1971. Now, this is before Spencer Kimball becomes president. But he came to one of you had a group that they called the Black Mormon Reunion. It was a gathering. And in 1971, if I understand this story correctly, Spencer Kimball comes to one of these gatherings. And this was something that I think, if I understand this right, gave you a sense of hope about things. Would you talk about that?
Yes. So let's go back a little bit and I'll lead up to that one. In 1968 to 69, my wife and I, because I wanted to find Black Mormons, because I didn't see any in the wars. So I found one or two in the beginning, and then when you find one or two, they'll tell you about somebody else. And so we had gathered about 30 inactive Black Mormons in the valley. And so 1969, my wife and I, we decided to have a Black Mormon reunion in our backyard. And that was our first Black Mormon reunion that we held. That was in 69. So we had about 30 people that came out to that one. And 1970, we had 75 that came out, 1970. That was in our backyard again that we fed the people and tried to board them up and lift their spirits. In 1971, we had at Rose Park, that's where we had it because it was getting too large to hold it in my backyard. We had 150 that came out. And that's when Spencer W. Kimball and his wife came to that one. Mm-hmm. And President Kimball, he held my youngest child in his lap while they were eating. And his wife held my daughter. And so when they left, they came back across the park from their car and said, we forgot to kiss the little children goodbye. So that's what they did. And so at the conclusion of all our meetings that we held with the Apostle Hinckley, Munson, and Packer prior to that, leading up to the assembly of the meeting to hold that we held to organize the Genesis group. And that was in October the 19th, 1971 of that year. So it changed from Black Mormon Reunion to Genesis.
What did it mean to you that Kimball had gone? Did that give you some sense that there was a possibility for change?
Well, I knew, again, through prayer. And so I had received a confirmation that my boys at the time would receive the priesthood when they reached of age to receive the Aaronic priesthood. So my son Antoine, that's my oldest boy, May the 6th, 1978, he turned 12. Hmm. And so the priesthood was given. See, people use the term revelation. That's the term they use. Yeah. I use the term that they gave the priesthood back to the blacks in 1978. But to appease the membership of the church, it has to be called or considered a revelation so that everybody can feel comfortable with that.
Greg Prince, the June 1st of 1978, Spencer Kimball meets in the Salt Lake Temple with his counselors and I think 10 of the apostles, two weren't there. What's happening on this particular moment? I mean, and we should maybe back up and say that he had spent, I guess it's fair to say, a number of years really trying to figure out how he could make this happen.
Yes, we don't know how long, but he said months and months and months. And he said often after a meeting with the 12 in the temple, he would go back to the temple alone and pray for hour upon hour trying to get the answer. I think by June 1st, he had the answer, but he knew that he had to get buy-in unanimously for this thing to work. And so what some later described as a Pentecostal experience happened that was life-altering for the men in the room and certainly historic for the entire church.
I wanted to ask you about the reaction to it, which is an opportunity to bring Eugene Orr back into the conversation. When you got word, Eugene, give me just your basic reaction to it.
Well, at the time, my profession was a painter, and I was painting in someone's house. I was doing some painting, and I got a telephone call from one of my friends here in Salt Lake City, Paul Barden. And he says, "Hey, Gene," he says, "something just great happened." And I says, "Okay, Paul." Because Paul is always, he was always joking and jiving about things. And so he says, "They just announced that blacks can have the priesthood." I said, "Paul, sure." And he said, "Well, call down to Salt Lake City, get some news, look on your news, and then you'll see." And so in my reaction may have been a lot different than most people. I had put in a lot of effort trying to bring things to pass. And yes, my quest had always been to receive the priesthood, because I left there in 1977. I pulled up my roots, yeah. And I felt that after I sent this special letter to the apostles, which those letters did not reach the apostles at all. The secretary sent them all back to me,
wow.
And I felt that if they didn't know our concerns, how would they be able to deal with our concerns? Even when we met with the three apostles before we organized Genesis, we met with them for 6 months. I think it was once a month, and we met discussing all these issues. And then, so when it happened, it wasn't a big surprise to me, but it was a relief that now that part is over. So now let's move forward to something else. And it kind of reminded me of the Civil Rights Bill that was passed in 1965. You can pass all the laws and the bills you want, but you don't change people's hearts. And so the same thing took place with the revelation of the priesthood in 1978. That took place, yes. But many, many people hearts did not change with that.
At what point did it become important for black members of the LDS Church? I mean, at first there's a sense of relief and joy, of course, that this had happened in 1978. But as you say, there was still, and I think we've heard conversations about this in the past, a good deal of racism that existed and still exclusion within the church. At what point did it become important for the church to resolve some of those misimpressions of the past and to apologize for the past?
Well, to dissolve some of the racial folklore with the people, it started with Brother President Hinckley somewhat in conference. He made some statements about to the priesthood hold in priesthood meeting about people and their attitudes and loving one another, regardless of people, a race or a ethnic group as well. So just recently is when President Nelson, he's a different prophet today. Mm-hmm. He has a different attitude about everything, and he just comes out and just move forward with everything. And so I think he's moving faster than what people had anticipated. For the blacks, it's great, but for many of our white brothers and sisters in the church, it is not so great because he's moving faster than what people can handle. I still see people attitudes in wards that I had attend, even in Canada. People they were a little bit more friendlier than those in the U.S., but they still followed the prophet. Hmm. The prophet says you can't hold the priesthood. You can't hold a priest. If you say that you're cursed, then you're cursed.
It's interesting, Greg Prince, that if you reflect back on this B1 celebration last Friday, you had these kind of conflicting emotions and conflicting things that were going on. On one hand, people have talked about the beauty of the music, that the inclusion of black and African culture, a celebration of universal love, a celebration that this ban had been lifted, but no real acknowledgement of the pain of the past in that meeting. And in fact, comments by President Dallin Oaks that I think some people construed as not really confronting the issue. And, you know, of course, there's always this conversation that about Dallin Oaks' previous statements that the church doesn't apologize and shouldn't apologize. Would you just talk a little bit about that? Why they won't apologize? Why there's some sort of institutional obstacle to dealing with that darker part of the past, that uglier part of the past?
It's human nature for organizations of any type not to want to apologize. It can be churches. It can be corporations. It can be governments. It's very rare that any of those institutions will come forward and say straight out, we made a mistake and we apologize for it. I think there is a strong parallel here, though, and that is the Mountain Meadows Massacre. That occurred in 1857. It dogged the church for a century and a half. And all during that time, the feeling of the senior church leaders was, we'll just lie low and this thing will go away. But it didn't, until finally they faced off directly and produced a definitive book on it written by church employees who had full access to the records. And when they finally came forward with the full response to the history and laid it all out there, then the problem receded to the background and we were able to go on. But it required that act of saying, we need to own the past and then we can move into the future. Mm-hmm. We're not there yet. We need to get there.
Is it a lack of humility? Is it an attempt to protect the institution that they're unwilling to – they're reticent anyway to just say we're sorry?
Well, if – I think there's a realization that there is a two-edged sword here. What cuts backward can cut forward as well. That if you admit that there were mistakes in the past, will that raise in the minds of current church members the possibility that you could make mistakes in the present and the future? Hmm. I think we need to get to the point where the answer to all of those is, yes, we made mistakes. Yes, we are making mistakes. And yes, we can make mistakes in the future because that's what defines our humanity. And it's fine. It's okay. And in fact, it will pull the members in tighter, I think, to realize we're all in this boat together. We all have our flaws, so let's work together and make it work.
Eugene, Orr, I want to give you the final word on this. How do you explain why it is that church leaders have been resistant to deal with the past and apologize for it to its black members?
Well, I think Bruce R. McClunky did that in a way down at BYU. He did, in many ways, apologize when he said that we had limited knowledge on these subjects. And so things that he said was incorrect. Forget about all the things that he said. And that upset a lot of people that who were white members, because as an apostle, well, you said those things and you wrote those things, and now you're saying to forget about it. And so the church don't the church are not using his talk that he gave, because that that talk disturbed and upset a lot of people. And yes, it's all about, like, you're trying to protect the people, not the blacks, but those of our white brothers and sisters.
Eugene Orr. He was a founding member of Genesis. It's a group for African-American members of the LDS Church. These days, he lives near Edmonton, Canada. He joined us from the studios of the CBC there. We also heard from Gregory Prince, a biographer and independent historian. He's the author of the book David O. McKay and the Rise of Modern Mormonism. He joined us from a studio in Washington, D.C. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Tess Goodwin. We had technical direction from Tim Slover. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Thank you.